very sad news to be hearing. I think awareness is a key element of that, and of course the cultural backgrounds will play into it naturally, but of course awareness is the key element on that, is the key message, and protect yourselves and others.
It's not a good disparity, certainly, and we need to investigate why that's occurring. So is it genetic? Is it lifestyle? Is it, I don't know.
It's sad, but it's quite, you know, possibly genetic, you know, that people realise on looking that there was quite a lot of.
So I don't know why. Maybe because they are not having the vaccine. It's because of due to religious reason, that can be the reason why they are dying more than the other group.
I think they're correct. I think a lot of the BAME community, they listen to a lot of stuff on Facebook and believe that than what the government's putting out, which I can understand that side as well. So sort of like a double-edged sword type of thing.
That's kind of expected. We live in a structurally racist society. Depending on the colour of your skin, you may find that you have different opportunities in terms of housing and employment. If you look at a lot of places of employment, black people are predominantly in roles where they continue to need to come into work right through all stages of the pandemic. So they were more exposed, and they probably still are.
I think that's pretty awful, to be honest. I think that something should be definitely done about that. I don't think any minority should be at a disadvantage to anyone else.
I think it's just how we're treated, or like how men from black BAME and backgrounds are treated in, like, whenever they like go to the hospitals, in like kind of the preconceived like judgments that they have. So yeah, I'd probably say maybe that's what's kind of attributing to those figures.
In what sense though? Because you can't just say your skin colour. You know, what is it? Dietary requirements? Have they been active? You know, what was gathered to get the answer? That's what I'm saying.
I think if they have got the death numbers by statistics, they are correct. And, you know, the government needs to find why the BAME are more susceptible to this disease rather than the white men, Hispanic men.
John White is a director, broadcaster and political commentator, specialising in geopolitics, political economy and issues related to class and race in British society.
Well, that became a stat that was doing the rounds in society. A lot of people jumped on what I think was the erroneous view that it's because of something innate within black people in terms of their immune system and how they were responding to the virus. I think it's more prosaic. I think it's an issue of class. I think in the UK, well, I don't think I know, in the UK, class is inextricably linked to ethnicity. Black men, Asian men, etc., ethnic minorities in total, they're disproportionately occupy the poorest paid sectors in the workforce, in the economy, in restaurants, in distribution, in cleaners, hospital porters, NHS nurses, etc., etc. So they were more exposed to the virus.
In the second wave of the pandemic, Bangladeshi men, for example, were five times more likely to die than white males. How can this increasing disparity be occurring?
I've no idea. I mean, yeah. Is there a fear of coming forward for treatment, or I don't know. It's things that we need to look at, certainly.
Maybe, well, should be something to look into as to why anybody's dying with it. But
it's not anyone doing it for that to happen. I would say it's because of people's background as well, ethnicity background. We're all brought up in a different way.
I'm not sure they're allowed to happen. I think there's ignorance, lack of analysis, lack of data. I think we now know that we could have protected those people better. I think we should have done, but without the data, without the analysis, it's very difficult to do that.
I don't know, the condition of living, I don't know, maybe the white people got more ways to survive on this virus, I don't know. But on this virus, that I don't believe.
Yeah.
Well, I think my understanding is possibly with Bangladeshi men, you might get more of an issue of poverty coming through. I think if you're just talking about people from an ethnic minority background generally, there were a lot of doctors who died.
A contributing factor could be that they tend to occupy multi-generational households, as far as I know. So transmission of the virus was greater amongst those households than it would have been in a sort of less crowded households, fewer people living together.
So there's larger multi-generational households sometimes. If you've got small kids at school, a lot of the time I understand that's been how things have been coming back. So kids get ill at school, they don't know about it necessarily, and then it goes through closer family groups.
I would imagine that if people come in and they're from an immigrant background, that it's much harder to get support from the government. So I just think if it's a statistic that's been recorded, the government should do more about it to help that community.
I mean, it just can't be, you know, Bangladeshi, British, you know, English. There's got to be something behind the scenes. And what is it? I think that's the question.
Can our experts explain the reasons there is such an increased risk of mortality for Bangladeshi and other ethnic groups?
The government's own website reveals that 30% of all Bangladeshi and Pakistani men are in the restaurant distribution sector. So they're more exposed to the virus. And so they're on the front lines, they're key workers. And key workers, absent PPE, which was the case at the start of the virus, the first lockdown, when you remember the PPE scandal, the scramble to get PPE, they were, bus drivers, etc., were sent to work without any protection. And they were dying in their droves. So I think the issue really at bottom is class. It's not ethnic differences, it's class differences.
Dr. Bob Gill is a general practitioner and activist who has been fighting the privatisation of the NHS and has directed, produced and presented the film The Great NHS Heist, which shows just how the US insurance giants are moving in on the NHS.
But there are also the effects of social deprivation, poverty, social inequality, which, you know, will put a chronic stress on people. Now, we know chronic stress has a negative effect on the immune system, and if you have other health conditions as well as a result of deprivation and inequality and poverty, well, that's a toxic combination, a cocktail that unfortunately will have a significant impact on those who are already vulnerable. So there are issues over and above just the exposure risk.
Blood oxygen meters are less accurate for people with non-white skin. Why is medical equipment allowed to be three times more likely to overread the oxygen in the body of a person with non-white skin in comparison to the accuracy achieved with those who do have white skin?
I've no idea, but definitely that's, you know, now that they do know, how much effort is going into making those meters more applicable to all colours of skin.
It's to do with the way it works. It sort of shines through the skin. So it doesn't work with nail varnish on the fingers because I can't remember what it is. It's red light don't get through.
Infrared
light don't get through properly. So, yeah, if it's darker skin, it is going to cause a problem, yeah.
Do you think we should be able to fix this?
Hopefully, yes, yes. We should be able to. You know, it should work on everybody's skin, whatever colour they are.
I've never heard about that one, so it's new. I'm not quite sure why it's not really, it's not reading on black skin.
Because they haven't been tested across a proper range of the population, and it's to do with the trials of how things are tested. I think you sometimes see similar disparities where drugs companies are unwilling to test drugs on young women. After the thalidomide scandal, they're always worried about pregnancy, so you've seen similar issues there.
If you look at Google, Google reflects society's prejudices, so there's great examples where if you search for unprofessional hair, all Google returns is images of people with black braided hairstyles. That's not unprofessional, it's just basically what society suggests in lots of documents, and that's what gets fed back to us. Getting the wrong readings on a blood oximeter is the same thing, it's negative feedback from structural racism.
I assume they've probably been built and tested on people who are from a white background. Again, I think in this day and age, probably need to update that quite drastically, because that's just not, well, it's not fair and it's not an accurate representation of the community anymore.
I don't think that they're updating the kind of medical equipment that they need regularly. So I think these these pulse oximeters have been made like from years back, and they're still using those same instruments. And yeah, it just needs to kind of be updated with recent figures to kind of counter all of that in, so that it isn't like inaccurate when it's coming up or when the results are coming out. Yeah.
Well, that's scandalous. I mean, that's something that definitely has to be looked at. And yeah, that could lead to, well, it's already led to, I'm assuming, negative or bad results. So yeah, I mean, it's not good.
What has led to a system where the very equipment used to measure blood oxygen levels gives such wrong readings for those with non-white skin? Here are the views of our experts.
It's unfortunate that the pulse oximeters haven't been adjusted to take account for the falsely, you know, good readings that they can sometimes show. And it's down to the design, the use of infrared light to estimate blood oxygen levels. And if you have pigmented skin, then you will get a false reading. But they should, to mitigate that, you know, in the short term, people should have been sent guidelines, health professionals should have been informed that, you know, don't ignore clinical judgment. You may need to reduce down in your, you know, allow for 5-10% overreading in the oximeter and take that into account. So you might have a patient who looks unwell, but the oximeter is reassuring. Well, if there was widespread knowledge of the false readings, then maybe that would have helped.
In the first wave of the pandemic, the rate of death from COVID-19 for black African males was 3.7 times greater than for white British males, and 2.6 times greater for females. For the Bangladeshi community, it was 3 times higher for males and 1.9 times higher for females. However, in the second wave, starting in September 2020, the differences in COVID-19 mortality for Bangladeshi and Pakistani ethnic backgrounds was even worse. The Bangladeshi group had the highest rate, 5 times higher for men and 4.1 times higher for women, versus the white equivalent statistics.
Some of the differences in mortality rates could be explained by the fact that ethnic communities tend to work in higher risk occupations like healthcare, indoor trade and transport. So in that context, are they getting proportionate and fair treatment when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, I only can comment on my own environment there. And there, yes, there is plenty of information, plenty of opportunity, plenty of impetus and attention being paid to it, yes.
Definitely. I mean, now that we're fully aware and we've got all of these statistics that indicate these people are at more risk, then we should be doing more. It's where I come from in Leeds. It's quite a deprived area and the schools aren't that great, so the sort of moving on to university is not as high as you in sort of other areas.
There's been a lot of encouragement and maybe it's just cultural and the beliefs are not sure, the different areas and that we're not, you know, don't understand exactly.
Just it's rather unfortunate that's happening because most of us are the one doing the hard work, I would say. So, but well, this is the country we live in, so we just need to continue the work we can do to help the country.
This country is for white people country, and people come from abroad, and they do whatever we do whatever is available to do.
It isn't, but I don't know what you can do about it when the pandemic's just started. You can't immediately rearrange people's jobs. I don't really know what to say about that.
Is it fair or is it not? These people have to work. They have to earn a living, and I think measures have been put in place because of the high incidence of, or the risk factor for these people.
It's not. Definitely, it's not fair anyway, whether it's during a pandemic or not. I think it just comes to light in a pandemic, and that's where it gets highlighted, unfortunately. But hopefully, with all of this data that you've kind of talked me through, hopefully people can take that on board and do something about it.
Depends what you mean by fairness, because obviously this country has quite a large proportion of ethnic minority groups, more so now than we ever have had. So
I'm not surprised that the figures relating to those jobs have gone up much higher.
So with greater risk occupations and racial bias in blood oxygen meters, how well has the government served ethnic communities, many of whom have been in the front line in saving the lives of others while putting themselves at risk?
Do you think the government's given, with all these problems, given enough attention to ethnic communities or us generally in terms of COVID?
No.
I think the government, I would say the government is trying, but I think he left things too late, made decision very late for us to get into this stage. I think if things was done earlier, a lot of things could have been avoided, I would say.
Do you think the government really has served ethnic communities in this country effectively over the last 2 years when it comes to COVID?
No, is the short answer.
Not very well, I don't think. It's been very inconsistent. The advice and the information that we've been given has been quite contradictory. One day we've got this and one day we've got that.
So I don't think it's done well. Again, I think there's a lack of data. What they need to do now is, frankly, get their arse in motion, if you excuse me saying so, and make sure this doesn't happen again, and that we now really look at these issues and really address them properly so that our ethnic communities from all different backgrounds feel more looked after and more that we research it more carefully and that we have the real data to make sure they're we are all equally privileged in this society.
Not well at all. Not well at all. I don't know that they could do anything before they had the answers. Like, when it hit, it just hit. And then you look back and there are obviously massive issues. But I think at the time when it hit, I don't know that there was much they could do about it. And they're short of healthcare workers, so it wasn't that there was a great pool of untapped white healthcare workers who could be drafted in when the pandemic hit.
I mean, I don't know a lot about the exact government policy that's out there at the moment, but what I do know and think now is that they should improve drastically and they should take action immediately to rectify that situation.
I don't think the government's done much, I'll be honest. I feel like they could have done a lot more to kind of, you know, really back the NHS and really, show that, you know, they are in, they're acting in the best interest of, like, medical staff and medical assistants. And
I think if there's something that's been discovered or perhaps, you know, that needs to be looked at further, I think the government in general, you know, whether it's healthcare, policing, you know, in general, it's just too slow. I think that's something the government needs to just, you know, it's been really bad during the COVID, and COVID has been used as a mask to make things slower, I think, and worse.
We gave our experts the chance to comment on the extent to which they believe the government has served those from ethnic communities who are literally the frontline team saving others from coronavirus while risking their own lives in the process.
Well, the government's handling of the pandemic for the whole population has been very bad compared to other countries. They failed to take mitigation. The advice was very confusing. We were getting mixed signals. Now, that had a greater impact on ethnic minorities because of the risks that we've discussed, greater exposure and the higher incidence of chronic illness. So I don't believe the government particularly were negligent towards the ethnic minorities. They were negligent to the whole population. I think this is more of a problem of class, working class and people at the bottom of society being ignored. Their needs ignored, and we haven't had the investment in public health measures. We haven't had the capacity build-up we needed in our health service, and that's affected the whole population, but it's taken a greater toll on ethnic minorities.
Research reveals measuring equipment overestimated oxygen saturation 3.6% of the time in white patients, but for black patients, it overestimated it 12% of the time. This means a built-in racial bias in medical equipment, which very likely has contributed to increased risks of serious illness and death in non-white patients suffering acute effects from COVID-19. The harsh reality is that members of ethnic communities are much more at risk from COVID-19 in the UK than people who are white. With discrimination built into the medical equipment and the dangers associated with frontline roles, all of this means that if you're not white, you're more likely to die during a pandemic that currently shows no signs of going away any more than that built-in ethnic bias. That's the lethal cost of being black and living in Britain during COVID-19.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'inur rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, commander-in-chief, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he was a governor, and when he was a leader, and he was chosen by people themselves, he was not being in election, he did not force himself into people, he was not appointed by his previous khalif, rather it was the choice of the people collectively, not just four or six, not by one. Even though he was the commander of the faithful appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but what can we do when people themselves, they want to be misguided, when people themselves, they wish to suffer, they left him alone. But now they're stuck. So they came to him, they chose him as a khalifa. They chose him as a khalifa, and they knew who Ali is. They knew the justice of Ali. Yet they had the audacity to come to him, and they asked him to seek wealth and to do injustice. So they came to him and they asked him to do certain actions that he rejected. And he rejected those who advised him to seek support by doing injustice and inequality to the Muslims of whom he was chosen as a guardian. They wanted him to fight Muawiyah in the same way that Muawiyah fought Imam Ali, by being a treacherous, by being deceiving, by cheating. This is not Ali alayhi salam. That is Muawiyah. That's evil. How could you dare ask Amir al-Mu'mineen to abide by these treacherous ways? Amir al-Mu'mineen rejected alayhi salam. In response to those who objected to his just distribution and wanted more property, referring to Umar's favorism to Arabs over non-Arabs, he said, "By Allah, even if it were my property, I would distribute it equally amongst them. How would it be when the property is theirs?" Now, before the Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, those who preceded him, they divided the wealth based on lineage. They divided the wealth based on whether you're an Arab or non-Arab, based the fact whether you're a servant or a free man. That's injustice. This is not Islam. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he was asked to divide money and wealth in the same manner that was done before him, he said, "Wallah, even if it was mine, I swear to Allah, if this was money, the money was mine, I would be fair and equal to people, all of them, regardless of their nationality, regardless of their background, regardless of their color, if it was mine. How about when the money is actually theirs? Under what circumstances, under what conditions, under what rule do I have to favor Arabs over non-Arabs? That's not justice, that's not Islam, and most certainly that is not Ali alayhi salam. So he rejected and he refuted what they offered him by saying something in return. Let us take a break, then we will continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, dear listeners. You are listening to the program For Humanity, and we are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, chief and master, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salamullah. When he was asked to divide money and obviously distribute it based on the fact there are Arabs and non-Arabs, and Arabs should get bigger, more share than non-Arabs, he refuted their argument by saying, to distribute wealth among those who do not deserve it amounts to squandering the wealth. The Holy Quran also says, do not squander wealth wastefully. The squanderers are indeed Satan's brothers, and Satan is ungrateful to his Lord. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, if I give my money, or if I divide money unfairly, I'm going to give people more than what they deserve. And when they have more than they deserve, they will waste it. And if they waste it, they will become brothers to the shaitan, because this is what the ayah in the Quran said. So you can see that the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam, him and the Quran are one. When he talks, when he delivers, when he argues with people, he argues based on the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is trying to apply the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which makes me wonder, where was the Quran when those who preceded Amir al-Mu'mineen were dividing wealth on their families and on their close relatives? Where were they from the Quran when one of them died, they had to break golden axes from his treasury? Where were they from the Quran when one of them, when he died, he had piles and piles of money and gold? Where were they from the Quran where Muawiyah and his household were giving a massive portion from the Muslim treasury because he was related to one of the successors or the so-called khalifs of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam? This is not me saying. You can pick up any history book and see what has happened. Where were they? Where was the Quran? Where was the teaching of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? Where was justice? It did not exist. Justice only saw the day of light when Ali alayhi salam was in power. The only time justice flourished when Ali alayhi salam was a governor. Justice only was applied when Ali alayhi salam was a ruler. Now, if you want to see the face of justice, go to Ali alayhi salam. Look at his life, and you cannot miss it. It doesn't matter who you are, a Muslim, non-Muslim, atheist, polytheist, monotheist. When you look at the justice of Ali, you will be amazed. You will be astonished. You will be out of breath, to the point that even Christians wrote many books about Ali alayhi salam and his justice, because he's the only human being after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam that managed to give justice its true value. We leave it here, and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Farm workers in the U.S., especially immigrant workers, have few protections. They were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act passed in 1935 and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Workers in America's agricultural fields are regularly subjected to abuses ranging from high occurrences of sexual assault and harassment, weight theft, and safety issues including injuries, fatalities on the job, and exposure to hazardous chemicals. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Michael Sainto under the heading, A Lot of Abuse for Little Pay, How U.S. Farming Profits from Exploitation and Brutality. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. In June, a farm worker from Mexico who requested to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation was transported through a trafficking network from Monterrey to work on farms in Georgia. They paid the traffickers 20,000 pesos, about $950, loaned from their mother, taking frequent trips back and forth to Monterrey before being told it was safe to leave. They were finally transported across the border. Initially, the worker was told they would be working on a blueberry farm, but was sent to a corn farming operation instead. The worker said, "We arrived at the house where we would live and had to clean the rooms ourselves. There were roaches, spiders, mosquitoes, and the mattresses were covered in lice," adding, "The bathrooms and showers were dirty and clogged. The kitchen was horrible. We had no air conditioning in hot weather." The worker began work daily at 3 or 4 a.m. local time and worked until 3 or 4 p.m. with just one 15-minute lunch break, making just $225 for 15 days of work. They heard rumors that the contractor had several workers die under them. The worker claimed that Haitian immigrants were also brought into the same network. After 20 days at the corn farm, the worker was sent to a cucumber warehouse where they weren't paid anything for their work and then transferred to Texas before escaping the operation and returning to Mexico in July. The worker added, "There was a lot of abuse for little pay," adding, "It was a total fraud." Contractor, the worker said he worked under J.C. Longoria Cancer, was one of 24 defendants indicted on federal conspiracy charges in October based on findings from a multi-year investigation into a massive human smuggling and labor trafficking operation based in southern Georgia that extended to Florida and Texas. The indictments characterized the operation as modern-day slavery, a long-standing issue in the U.S. agricultural industry, where Workers were smuggled from Central American countries to the U.S. and imprisoned as contracted farm workers. Farm workers in the U.S., especially immigrant workers, have few protections. They were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act passed in 1935 and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Workers in America's agricultural fields are regularly subjected to abuses ranging from high occurrences of sexual assault and harassment, wage theft and safety issues including injuries, fatalities on the job, and exposure to hazardous chemicals. The investigation Operation Bloomberg Union found the conspirators forced workers to pay fees for transportation to the U.S., food and housing through the H-2A work visa program, while withholding the travel and identification documents and forcing them to work for little to no pay in inhumane living conditions. According to the investigation, the 2,000 conspirators made $200 million from their operation, laundering the money through land, homes, over a dozen vehicles, and the purchase of a restaurant and a club. Over 100 workers were freed from the operation. The H-2A visa program is an often used avenue for exploitation of migrant workers in the U.S., as it ties immigration status to employment on a temporary basis with no pathways to permanent citizenship. Many of these workers are forced to take on debt to recruiters to enter the H-2A visa program, with several cases of debt, peonage, forced labor, and human trafficking reported through the program. Daniel Costa, director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, said it's really the structure of the program that facilitates this kind of stuff happening, often with impunity. He cited a severe lack of labor law enforcement in the agricultural industry as a driving factor in widespread abuses of workers and the lack of regulating recruiters outside the U.S. who connect migrant workers with temporary jobs. Inspections conducted by the Wage and Hour Division of the U.S. Department of Labor declined significantly over the past few days due to underfunding and the low number of inspectors responsible for overseeing a vast number of employers. Costa added, if you are an agricultural employer, there is only around a 1% chance that you will be investigated for anything in any given year, so they can pretty much get away with not treating your workers the way they should. The workers were threatened with deportation or violence if they did not comply with the conspirators. The indictments include allegations of raping, kidnapping, and threatening or attempting to kill some of the workers or their families, and in many cases sold or traded the workers to other conspirators. The indictment said at least two workers died as a result of the living and working conditions, and another was repeatedly raped. Some of the workers were promised up to $12 an hour in pay, but instead were ordered by armed overseers to dig up onions by hand for 20 tenths dollars per bucket. A grand jury indicted the 24 conspirators in a federal court in Waycross, Georgia, on counts including forced labor, mail fraud, witness tampering, and conspiracy to commit money laundering. Arraignments in the case were scheduled for December 21st and January 6th at the Southern District of Georgia Federal Courthouse in Waycross, Georgia.
This is A to Z.
an introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, attention to weak strata. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being attentive towards the weak strata. Now, there is a group of people who are weak, who are needy, who are poor, and they need help of others. And we, being rich, or maybe we belong to a middle class, or maybe we do not sleep hungry at night. Therefore, we have something to share with the others. Whereas there are many, many people, out there who lives in the streets, who do not have anything, who needs our help, who even do not have anything to eat at night. Therefore, or there are many people who just have food for one time, maybe at the morning or afternoon or in the evening. So they just eat one time. They have one meal for the whole day. Therefore, if we are having three meals in a day, we can share something with them, because it is recommended to have two meals, like breakfast and the dinner. So therefore, even if we can share one-time meal with others, this is something at least which we have done for the others, inshallah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being attentive towards the weak strata, and we said that if we share our one meal with the others, those who even do not have anything to eat, or those who have just one meal in a day to eat, if we share that, it is something that we have done, and it is according to the narrations. And this is what Islam basically promotes us to do. And on top of that, when we talk about the consumption, Islam talks about the consumption as well. It says there is a boundary of consuming things, and we must consume things up to a limit, and we cannot exceed that limit. Therefore, if we share things with the others and we do not waste things, then we will be amongst those who are looking after the society, and they're looking after their brothers and sisters in Islam, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations General Assembly has backed an open-ended war crimes probe against Israel, including into the regime's recent 11-day war on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed at least 260 Palestinians, including over 60 children. An overwhelming majority of 125 countries voted in favor of the investigation. It was initially approved by the UN Human Rights Council in the aftermath of the Gaza War in May. The inquiry allows for a review of Israeli human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. No such open-ended investigation has ever been launched against any other UN member. The vote came after Israel's amendment to defund the probe was rejected 125-8 with 34 abstentions. Israel itself and the United States were among the few that voted against the approval of the budget for the investigation. Palestine's permanent ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, praised the vote and all the countries that rejected Israel's proposal. He thanked the UN General Assembly for approving all budgets of the programs relating to the Palestinian cause, including his request to increase funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. envoy to the U.N., who voted against the probe, said Washington will continue to oppose the investigation and to look for opportunities in Geneva to revisit its mandate. This is another example of how Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any prosecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes. Speaking of vetoes, the United States has vetoed dozens of United Nations Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, including at least 53 since 1972. Washington's unequivocal support of Israel has seen it thwart resolutions condemning violence against Palestinian protesters, as well as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank built since 1967. The U.S. has vetoed at least 4 UN Security Council resolutions condemning Israel's settlements on Palestinian land, which are considered illegal under international law. The U.S. support of Israel also has encouraged settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis.
Israel will prevent participation by people, by investigators. I don't think Israel will allow them into the country, whether it's this year or next year. As long as they have the backing of the United States, they continue to be able to refuse to deal with international condemnation and international investigation of the undoubted crimes that go on a daily basis against the Palestinian people.
Last week, to mark the 5th year since the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an end to all settlement activities in the Palestinian territories, UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, issued a statement calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He stated that one statistic above all illustrates the remarkable reluctance of the international community to enforce its own directions respecting the Israeli occupation. According to his statement, when Resolution 2334 was adopted in 2016, there were an estimated 400,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and 218 in East Al-Quds. 5 years later, there are 475,000 settlers in the West Bank and 230,000 in East Al-Quds, an increase of 12%. The surge in the number of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories shows how Tel Aviv ignores the 2334 resolution that states Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease.
What allows the state of Israel to ignore the UN, many UN resolutions condemning the actions taken by Israel against the Palestinians on many different fronts. What allows Israel to continue to do that is the support that it has from the United States, that it's under the umbrella of United States protection. It's almost like Israel is the 51st state of the United States, the way that it's treated by the U.S. government. And this goes through Republicans and Democrats over the years. And so what it's done is it allowed these atrocities to go on.
Concluding his statement, the UN official said only an approach based on accountability, equality, and full rights for all can create the possibility of a prosperous and shared future for Palestinians and Israelis alike. But Tel Aviv has invariably avoided all attempts at bringing it to account over its decades-long aggression against Palestinians and other regional nations, thanks to staunch support by its oldest and strongest ally, the United States.
Prison is a disturbingly common experience for Palestinians. Since 1967, around one-fifth of Palestine's population has, at one time or another, been imprisoned. But the issue of Palestinian prisoners went viral on September 6th when the alarm at Israel's heavily guarded Gilboa prison went off following a jailbreak by six Palestinian inmates. Israeli authorities launched a manhunt for the inmates and toughened the situation for the rest of the prisoners, which prompted protests and hunger strikes that lasted for weeks. The spotlight, however, fell on six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners who were protesting their detainment without any trial under an Israeli policy dubbed administrative detention. On November 7th, some 4,500 Palestinian inmates went on a day-long hunger strike in solidarity with the six. Two of the hunger strikers, who had refused to eat for over 3 months straight, were later released. The strikes have shed new light on the plight of Palestinians in Israel's massive prison system, which currently holds over 4,500 political detainees and inmates on dubious charges. On top of that, Palestinian residents have been subject to violence by Israeli settlers who remain immune from any consequences. If anything, like the raid on the Palestinian village of Jalud in mid-May, Israeli troops come to the aid of the settlers and arrest the victims, not the aggressors. Rights groups say violent settlers are just another tool in Israel's inventory to remove the Palestinians from their lands. Their population is growing fast as the number of settlements built and planned to be built on the occupied territories are rising sharply. Israel pressed ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies like the many years before. It has razed, forced people to demolish, or seized multiple Palestinian-owned structures, including in East Al-Quds. In fact, such practices by Tel Aviv increased about 21% in 2021 compared to the year before. Israel has been increasingly evicting Palestinians from their homes, arguing that they lack permits. But it's virtually impossible for the Palestinians to obtain permits in areas including Area C and East Al-Quds. The evictions are usually done on such short notice that the residents cannot take the matter to the court. The United Nations says Israeli authorities have refused to grant permits to at least a third of Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, potentially placing over 100,000 residents at risk of displacement. Israel's plans to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, however, sparked an outcry that reverberated across the international community. Protests against the plan, especially those around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, turned violent, with Israeli troops cracking down on Palestinian demonstrators and storming the holy site in early May. That coincided with the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The tension sparked a conflict between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli military in what turned into an 11-day war on the besieged enclave. The Israeli army razed several structures in the strip, including a high-rise building that housed the office of several media outlets in Gaza, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. The Israeli atrocities drew widespread condemnation, with people around the world holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Some observers believe the war was a distraction from a lingering political uncertainty in Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone parliamentary elections that could have been a referendum on his rule. 2021 was a tragic year for Palestine. The events that unfolded over the past year proved that despite what some Arab nations claim, their normalization with Israel did not help the Palestinian cause, but might have even emboldened Tel Aviv to escalate its aggression on the Palestinians. The past year, however, was a year of unity and solidarity too, with Palestinians concluding that resistance is the only means to truly stand against the occupation and fight for freedom. The incidents and headlines in the past 12 months also raised awareness for more people across the world of how life is like for a Palestinian.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian Foreign Minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's foreign minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe, but it is within the European continent, and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached.
European Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Iran and the five remaining parties to the JCPOA resumed talks in Vienna on November 29 after a five-month hiatus, marking the first round of negotiations under President Ebrahim Raisi's administration and the seventh overall. During the seventh round of the Vienna talks, Iran presented two draft texts which addressed separately the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group of countries resumed the talks at the Austrian capital on December 9, when the participants returned to their capitals for additional consultations on the two draft proposals that Tehran had put forward. Since the U.S. administration under Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, the EU refused to play a constructive role to revive the deal. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, but the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no options but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal. Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has said that European companies can end contracts with Iranian firms pressured